Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Nancy Harris and Paddy Burnock on writing and directing the great series The Dry, which returns for its third and final season. Is the Michael Jackson biopic Michael as bad as everyone is saying? Let's find out. And a brilliant new book all about the changing nature of American film music in the 60s and beyond. You can email us screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I do hope you're doing well and enjoying some of this nice weather. On Thursday night, two of my three kids, well, they're not kids, they're children. They're not animals. Well, they were outside for 3 hours solid with their pals in the front and back garden. 3 hours without really coming in. I mean, there was the odd crying break and drink break, but they were outside in essence for 3 hours. I don't think they've been outside for 3 hours since last summer. So, hallelujah. It seems like some good weather is here. Anyway, and it seems like some good TV is here as well, because this week I was watching this.
I really was here for a reason more than just wrestling.
The fans liked believing Hulk was Superman.
Is it art? Is it fakery? What is it?
Well, there she goes. 1, 2, kick out.
Life was so clear. Where did that life go? The mistakes shown through.
Most of us think of Hulk Hogan as the king of the ring. But was there a sinister side to his success?
What Hogan preaches is apparently not what he practices.
I was running pretty hard partying. Maybe I was drunk. Maybe I was hot. I don't know what to tell you.
It's kind of like a recipe for disaster.
There are millions of kids that have believed in me and what I stand for.
You're a liar.
The character was so strong, Terry got lost along the trip.
Hulk Hogan has torn down everything that he once built.
Really want me to tell the truth? Okay. Sure, I know where all the bodies are buried.
Yes, you know that's obviously about Hulk Hogan. This is a four-part docuseries, Hulk Hogan, Real American, that landed on Netflix this week. I remember being a kid in the 80s and we had a channel called Sky One and I watched WWF wrestling for the first time and this guy Hulk Hogan came out. I remember thinking, who on earth is this guy? Well, this show on Netflix pretty much answers it. Hulk Hogan, as you know, passed away a couple of months ago and this documentary series has his final interview and he sits and in fairness to him is quite frank about his highs and lows, and by golly they are extreme highs and lows. Hulkamania at its height in the 1980s when Hulk Hogan seemed to be everywhere was huge. He was in Rocky movies. There was so much merchandise around him. It was incredible. And of course he was the star of this giant wrestling conglomerate and he was the centerpiece of it, and nearly part of the problems that emerged in his life had to do with the fact that they found it very hard to replace him, and he stayed a lot longer in wrestling than maybe he should have. Now, I don't want to give it all away, but what this documentary series captures very well is those highs, but the lows that involve steroids, sex tapes, lawsuits, Trumpomania. It really is a tale of extremes. And they even comment on kind of how he looked. You forget Hulk Hogan kind of looked like a guy in his 50s from the age of 20 and never seemed to get that much older or younger looking, if you know what I mean. This is a pretty gripping watch. It's not always pleasant, but he's quite frank about how much he screwed up at times. And he made a big mess of things at times. He really did. And there's a sadness to some of this, and he had a weird relationship with his dad, as so many of these troubled stars seem to have had. But I found this really gripping viewing, and had that old test of I was falling asleep, but I just wanted to get to the end of the episode to see what was next in this very storied life. So that is Hulk Hogan, Real American. It's now on Netflix. It's four parts. You'll really get stuck into it. And again, like all great shows that have anything to do with sport or great documentaries, you need to know nothing about wrestling or have any interest in wrestling and all its machinations of Bret the Hitman Hart and Andre the Giant. It's very apparent what's going on in this. So a big thumbs up for Hulk Hogan, Real American on Netflix. Let me know what you might have been watching this week. ScreenTime@NewsTalk.com is the email address. Yes, now you're listening to Screen Time. We turn to the big new release of the week and one of the most controversial of the year, and maybe any other year. It is the new Michael Jackson movie, simply called Michael. I have seen it. It's getting terrible reviews. They're probably not going to get much better in the next 10 minutes or so. Delighted to say, a regular reviewer on this show we haven't seen in a while. He's been busy. Chris Wasser is back and has seen Michael as well. Chris, hello, how are you?
John, I'm great. Great to be back. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Listen, there's a lot about this. You know, there's 7 million things we could say about it. Let's just start with the plot. What do we have going on in this? What part of Michael Jackson's life is it?
Yeah, you know what? It's a little bit weird to talk about the plot of this film, because to offer up any sort of meaningful description of a plot would be to kind of trick potential audience members into thinking there is one. I don't believe after watching 2 hours of this thing, and if I was to watch it again, even tomorrow, that I would be able to give you a plot. It's just sort of snippets. It's all random beats and, you know, odd eulogies and, you know, concert footage and, you know, reconstructed studio meetings. There is a bit of story in there, but what you have is Anton Fuqua, director of Training Day, and John Logan, the co-screenwriter of Gladiator, piecing together bits and pieces from Michael Jackson's, from the first parts of Michael Jackson's career. Between 1966 and 1984. So we kind of get, you know, snippets of the early years when his father, Joe Jackson, portrayed here by Coleman Domingo, and who we know was a bully from day one, when he assembles the Jackson 5 at their home in Gary, Indiana. And he essentially bullies the kids into you know, he tells them that, you know, in life there are winners and losers, and you're not going to be losers, and that's that. You're not just going to take yourselves out of here. It was important that he got himself out of Indiana. Then in the middle of the film, we have like soapy flashes of the solo career starting to come together. Jafar Jackson, nephew of Michael Jackson, playing Michael as very much a guy who loved playing, you know, in this band with his brothers, but also wanted to branch out. And we have this, you know, reconstruction of the Thriller album production, where apparently, or at least according to this film, the most important part of that whole process was deciding on a name. We'll come back to that in a minute. You also have, you know, Michael meeting his entertainment lawyer and manager, John Branca, played by a visibly uncomfortable Miles Teller. We have the introduction of Bubbles the Chimp, the mansion and all the animals that would come with it. Scenes where, you know, Michael is shown buying up an entire gift shop and then visiting sick children in the hospital. And just all the bits and pieces throughout his solo career that, you know, made Michael Jackson the superstar that he is. But at no point do we ever kind of get any examination of the human behind the superstar.
Yeah, so there's, you know, very little examination of his interior life.
Yeah.
I was saying, you know, that earlier in the week on Claire Byrne, that, you know, in these biopics, be it Elton John, Bruce Springsteen, there's this, often it's a father who's mean to them and horrible to them, and yet we see how this affected them. And in this, there's none of that. We just see that he liked hanging out with animals.
Yeah, it's a weird one. I mean, I thought Melania, the Brett Ratner documentary about the First Lady of the US, I thought that was the year's dreariest cinematic puff piece. But it's not. It's Michael. Now, to be fair, you do have a competent, capable cast at the center of this film. I love Coleman Domingo, and I still do even after watching this film. And I've time too for Miles Teller. And also, look, credit to Jafar Jackson. I don't think, not even the most studious, talented young actor on the planet could shape a three-dimensional protagonist from the screenplay that's been provided by John Logan and the direction by Anton Fuqua. But Jafar Jackson, who's never been in a film before, he does provide, you know, a loosely entertaining impersonation, but that's kind of all it is.
Yeah, it's an impersonation.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he's you know, this guy was his uncle, and he can take him off very well. And I think maybe, you know, if it was another artist and there weren't, you know, if there wasn't the elephant in the room, which we'll get to, a performance like this might be talked about in terms of awards buzz. But I don't think there will be awards buzz. And I'm kind of hoping there won't be, because if there is, John, I'll have to retire.
I don't know. Even if there wasn't that elephant in the room, I'm not sure if he's worthy of awards for that performance. I thought it was an impersonation. But look, tell me this, right? We keep mentioning the elephant in the room. So everybody in the world knows Michael Jackson was never found guilty of a single crime in a court of law. There was out-of-court settlements. There was very strange relationships with children, which are well documented, sharing his bed with children that weren't his, by his own admission. There have been numerous accusations, to cite in particular the documentary Leaving Neverland, of those two young boys at the time, which left a lot of people shocked and confused. So whether he was guilty of child sex abuse or not, that is a massive part of the Michael Jackson story. And there is no mention of that in this.
Yeah, it is quite astonishing. And I don't think it's a spoiler or a surprise to reveal that, you know, that this film, which was co-produced by the Jackson Estate, it avoids any accusations of wrongdoing. There is nothing in this film that would risk, you know, casting Michael Jackson in a bad light. So the film never mentions the child molestation charges against him. It never mentions the ensuing police and tabloid investigation that dominated headlines in 1993. And then also, you know, 10 years later, when there were more accusations, when there were, you know, more TV interviews that brought up a lot of things from the past. Instead, and, you know, the filmmakers, they might defend themselves by saying, well, the film wraps before any of that stuff took place. And it is true, because, as I said, the story takes place between 66 and 84, and then there's a quick flash to 1988 on the London leg of Michael Jackson's 1988 Bad Tour, just to give you more concert footage, because there's an awful lot of reenacted concert footage in this thing. And instead of a to be continued card at the end of the film, which I think a lot of people were expecting, because there were rumors that there were going to be two parts of this thing, and I think there still will be, we get a his story continues announcements before the credits roll. And I think what the filmmakers are doing there is that, you know, they're biding their time. They might have, they do have footage left over. They absolutely do. And they have hopes to turn the second part of Michael Jackson's life and career into another film. But they have to see if they are allowed to do that, and if they can, if this film is a success. Because rumor has it that Anton Fuqua, he completed a 4-hour version of Michael at one point. And look at that name. Look at that title, Michael. That tells you everything. You know, that tells you that this film was originally, you know, planned to cover absolutely everything. And it was. We know that Antoine shot scenes around that whole 1993 story. We know that he shot scenes around those initial allegations, but apparently very late in the day, lawyers and producers came forward and said, there's a thing in this settlement between Jordan Chandler and Michael Jackson's, Michael Jackson and Jordan Chandler's family, that says that stuff in this case can't be dramatized. And they've completely, they missed that. So stuff had to be taken out. The film had to be edited, reshot in places. A new ending had to be put in. And to fulfill contractual obligations, a film had to be put out. So the 2-hour, film we're getting is basically the studio saying, we have to put this thing out. And we'll, you know, if it's a success and people want a second part, we'll deal with those complications later on. And I think there will be a second part released in cinemas at some point, John, but I just don't know what that's going to look like.
Yeah.
Well, so just to
go back to the non-disclosure agreement, I mean, that's perfectly true, as far as I understand it, that there was this reference in the contract when they settled out of court that this could not be discussed or fictionalized. But and maybe it shouldn't be, but that in no way means they could not have addressed the molestation accusations, because there was a myriad of them. And you know that is a real cruel get out of jail card, I would suggest, that they're saying there was this NDA with this particular child, who's, because they could have gone to lots of other rumored cases as well.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's astonishing that you have a film called Michael about the life of Michael Jackson, and you don't mention the story that everyone's been talking about now for decades, and that the filmmakers are at pains to defend them. And at times, this film looks as though it's just one big PR exercise, one big, very expensive PR exercise that's been designed, performed, and marketed by the people closest to Michael Jackson, who are trying to kind of, you know, revive his public image. And it's made by people who, I believe, really should know better. But you can see right through it. It's using the music as an excuse to kind of, you know, make up excuses for Michael Jackson, basically. So it's, I'd say, John, a good error of this is just, you know, reenacted concert footage, to the point where when people actually start talking to one another on screen, you're surprised that there's any dialogue. You can't remember the last time that someone spoke to one another. Imagine, for instance, remember the last 15 minutes of Bohemian Rhapsody, a film that I disliked immensely, but I will say on a technical level, the Live Aid stuff is very well done. But imagine if the Live Aid stuff was scattered throughout the entire film. Imagine, you know, just an hour and a half of that. That's what, you know, this film feels like. And we can totally sit here and say that, you know, the songs were brilliant. They are. And that the performances and the concerts were, you know, game changing. They were. But there are other parts of Michael Jackson's life that you cannot ignore and that you shouldn't ignore. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very strange and quite a wrong thing to do, to push this film out and just pretend that all that stuff didn't exist.
Absolutely. And there's also, aside from the concert footage, there's also just his songs playing and him starting to write them, and nothing else is happening. And people are just walking around like this script is threadbare. I mean, the one moment in it that redeem is too strong a word, but when they were in the offices of Walter Yentnikoff, and I know a bit about that time, I know this is true. He was the record company executive, and he threatened to pull all his other artists from MTV unless they played Michael Jackson videos, because MTV didn't at the time because he was black. But like, that was probably the 3 minutes in the movie where I kind of sat up and took notice and didn't feel as kind of awkward, but the rest of it I did. Tell me this, you know, I don't think I've ever seen one of these biopics where there isn't a love interest. In all of them, Amy Winehouse, Rocket Man, oh, you know, it goes on and on. There was some great love, be it with a man or a woman or whatever. If you knew nothing about Michael Jackson, you would be left thinking he's asexual.
Oh, yeah. And that he spent every minute of his time when he wasn't in the studio or he wasn't on tour with animals. Yeah. I mean, this film is more interested in showing you Michael Jackson having conversations with llamas and chimps and snakes than it is in exploring, you know, again, yeah, say the man behind the legend or any sort of relationships that this man might have had with anybody, be it, you know, Janet Jackson, who is completely deleted from history. Yes. You know, she said herself and the family have been saying that she didn't want any involvement in this project. That's one thing. Another is to pretend that she never existed. Yeah. So I think that's quite disrespectful. There's no relationship with Elizabeth Taylor. There's no camaraderie or relationship with other artists, which we know that Michael Jackson had, you know, because he was such an important figure in the music industry throughout the 70s and the 80s. Nobody ever asks Orko questions about his behavior, despite the fact that, as I say, he walks around all the time holding hands with a chimp. It's astonishing that no effort has been made to kind of, you know, just explore what he was like as a person, and also how he came up with the things that he was coming up with. Because, mm-hmm, you know, there were times in the studio where he was coming up with magic, but mm-hmm, there's never any, you know, meaningful examination of that magic. And I just don't think you can, you know, we can say that this film is terrible because, you know, it ignores some deeply problematic parts of Michael Jackson's life, and we can say that it's terrible because there's, you know, you can't just piece together reenacted concert footage and call it biopic. But it goes much further than that. The script is quite, you know, thin. The performances are quite wooden. I don't think it looked all that great. It's kind of thrown together. It has no real beginning, middle, and end. It's quite shapeless because of all the edits. Just as, you know, the film as a whole just doesn't work.
It certainly doesn't. It's like a bad TV movie. So, I'm nearly afraid to ask, but what star rating would you give for Michael, which is in cinemas from, it's there now, it's been here since Wednesday. So, should you want to ignore everything Chris and I have said, or should you want to see what everyone's talking about, or maybe you just think he's worthy of just a piece of utter homage, it is in cinemas for you to go and see. But what are you going to say stars-wise for Michael, Chris?
It's a hagiography. That's all it is. A PR exercise, you know, a film that just takes all the positive entries in Michael Jackson's Wikipedia page and tries to make a biopic out of it. But that's not how biopics work. I just found it to be as dumb as a rock, as deep as a puddle. It has no dramatic worth. And the worst part, John, is that it will probably, based on the sales of Michael Jackson's music, even after all these years and even after all the stories and documentaries that we've come across, his music sales are on the rise. So this thing will probably make a fortune, and which means that a sequel is probably inevitable. It'll be so awkward, but it is inevitable. But I'm afraid it's one star for this first part.
Okay, I think I go along with that. I think I have to give it one star as well. I was wondering, with the continuing backlash, will they, you know, rescind plans to do a part two. But I mean, if it does go gangbusters at the box office, they probably won't, because as this movie is proof in point, money talks. Chris, if we were to end on a positive note, you did see something else in the cinema this week about as diametrically opposed, I think, to a Michael Jackson biopic, a subway horror movie called Exit 8.
Yes, please do spend your money on this one and go see it in a cinema. It's based on a best-selling video game. It's about a Japanese man who winds up trapped in this infinite underground subway loop. How does he get out? It's all one big game of spot the difference. He has to spot anomalies in, you know, every time that he's on his way to an exit in the subway station, or he thinks he's on his way to an exit, he ends up back at the start unless he spots little anomalies on the wall. There's instructions for the man. There's instructions for the audience. It's one of those rare video game adaptations that works, because other video game adaptations often make the viewer feel as if they're watching someone else play a game. This one keeps the audience in mind, and I felt like I was stuck in the tunnel and that I needed to get out with this guy. So I felt like I was working with this poor man to try and get out. It's chilling, it's clever, it has a great concept, a great story too. It is actually about something, it's not just a game, and it is, you know, most importantly for a horror, genuinely frightening. So go see that this weekend instead.
And what star rating would you give Exit 8?
I'd go for 4 stars.
4 stars for Exit 8, a possibly generous 1 star for Michael, which is in cinemas. Chris, great to have you back. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there, reviewing Exit 8, but I suppose more importantly for the week that's in it, the new Michael Jackson biopic, simply called Michael. And we both, because I've seen it as well, gave it 1 star. I should point out as well, just for those of you who thought we were very hard on it, it gave me no pleasure. The first album I ever owned was Michael Jackson's Bad, and I played it, you know, as Brian Adams said, till my fingers bled. I cried because I wasn't allowed to go see him in Páirc Uí Chaoimh because it wasn't in Dublin where I grew up. I was a massive fan all through most of my young life, and would still like to be where things a bit different. But that has nothing to do with the fact that this is just a bad whitewash of a movie. So there you go. And in happier news, I should mention, I didn't want to say it to him on air, but Chris Wasser was away, as you heard there, because he was off getting married. So I didn't want to embarrass him on air, but congratulations to Chris and his lovely new wife, Michelle. After the break, some more good news. The great series, The Dry, is back, and I talked to its writer and its director. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, another show I was watching this week was this.
I've always given women a leg up. Look at Shiv. Came in a lowly secretary with no qualifications.
Well, a degree in fine art.
Now she's coordinating our new International Artist in Residence programme.
Yeah, listen, Dervila, thanks. This is massive and I really appreciate it.
You're still at reception on Fridays.
Okay.
That, of course, was Roisin Gallagher being told that she would still have to work on Fridays as a receptionist. One of the great Irish shows of recent years that we talked about and raved on this show was The Dry, and is The Dry. It sees Roisin Gallagher return home to Ireland and attempting to stay, as the name implies, sober. She returns to a family that is peopled with a wonderfully dysfunctional bunch in the form of mother Bernie, played by Pam Boyd, dad Tom, played brilliantly by Ciarán Hinds, sister Caroline, played by the equally brilliant Siobhan Cullen, and the brother Ant, played by Adam John Richardson. There's also an ex and somewhat of a nemesis, played by our old friend Mo Dunford. It's a show that's both funny and sweet. Season 3 of The Dry starts on RT1 this Thursday, and all episodes will be available on the player, and that's from April 23rd, depending on when you're listening to this show. And in this season, the Sheridans unearth a huge family secret that sends everyone running around. There's also baby on the way. The show was written by playwright and screenwriter Nancy Harris, and it was directed by an old friend of the show, Paddy Bernack, who, I'll just remind you, one of his credits is the great I Went Down. And I'm delighted to say that Nancy Harris joins me from London, because due to my exorbitant salary, we couldn't fly her over. And Paddy Bernack is in studio with me because he just came in from break. Nancy, I'm going to start with you. You know, great TV shows, comedies or otherwise, to my mind, begin with like a concept. So Only Fools and Horses has two brothers and a grandfather who are wheeler and dealers. The Sopranos has a mob boss who's in therapy. And then once they take off, you forget about the concept behind them. And in a way, it's just about the great characters people kind of have fallen in love with or have come to loathe, but become part of their kind of lives, if you know what I mean. And it seems to me The Dry has done that. We care what happens to Shiv. We care about her parents' marriage. Is that so, that's very highfalutin, but I'm just wondering, is that something you're aware of, that maybe the initial idea of it has nothing to do with it anymore and it's just these characters we all kind of love?
Absolutely. I mean, that is a spot on observation, in that often the concept that you start with is not the central thing as the show grows and develops. And this concept was sort of an alcoholic, you know, a girl who gets sober actually before the show begins. So she is sober 6 months at the very start of the first episode, comes back to her family from London, wanting kind of support and understanding in that sobriety. And instead of meeting that from her family, she meets kind of disapproval, suspicion, problematic, you know, that she's a problem, actually, that the alcoholism is suspect. Mm. And through her sobriety, she actually ends up, with sobriety requiring her to be honest, she actually ends up, it's the catalyst for actually exploding all their secrets and putting them all under the microscope. Mm. So in a way, while sobriety and alcoholism is a theme, really it's about family, it's about relationships, it's about all of our lives and the problems we encounter and love and sex and everything. So you're right that it doesn't start necessarily with that premise of just somebody trying to stay sober.
Yeah, absolutely. Paddy, it's season three. I've watched 4 of the 8, but we know it's over. The press release has told us that. Was there like a elegiac feeling on set? Like, was there sadness at times that this is the last time we're doing this? Or are you just so busy with the labor getting it done?
I think when you're shooting it, you don't feel that. Mm. But definitely in the last couple of weeks, in the build up to it being screened, there's a kind of feeling of, you know, that it's reached an end. And I kind of think, you know, an end is beautiful. And there's something really, when you have a definite end and it's punctuated, and it feels like it's, you know, the last breath, the full stop, whatever way to describe it, that's there. As soon as that happens,
yeah,
and you want it to happen, there's a paradox. You want it to be over to find out what happens. But at that moment, you begin to feel what you're going to miss.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really lovely space for where a good ending happens, that you want it to conclude, but at the same time, you don't want to say goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the sense that we all had about it, and hopefully the audience will as well.
Yeah. Nancy, it's not a spoiler, and I've been actually given a list of spoilers, and I'm treading very carefully, but at the end of season 2, Siobhan Cullen was pregnant. So it's fair to say, if all goes to plan, there could be a baby in season 3. Were you keen to bring in kind of, you know, people have talked about, you know, messy women in shows like this. Were you keen to bring in, and that's probably a phrase you don't like, I don't either, but for want of conversation purposes, did you want to bring in messy motherhood?
You're right. No, you're right that I don't love the phrase, because it kind of sometimes gets thrown at us all, yeah. Women, particularly women creators.
Yeah, men are rarely messy. It's mostly women.
Yeah, it's like we've had
messy.
A lot of troubled direct detectives, but no one mentions them. But I was keen to, actually, I was keen to examine motherhood I feel like in recent years, we've had a lot of stories, rightly, because it's needed to happen, of traumatic motherhood.
Mm.
And Caroline is a type A person who you imagine would not be maternal.
Mm.
And actually, I think there's a really interesting story, which is that not that she's not maternal, but that her access to her child is becoming disrupted by external events.
Yeah.
So her natural ability to mother is being stopped. And it's interesting that actually she doesn't turn out to be the kind of character you suspect that might find the messiness of motherhood hard. It's not that. It's other things. It's the fact she's living with her mother-in-law. Yeah. That sort of stuff.
Who doesn't love that?
Who doesn't love that? Everyone loves that.
Paddy, tell me this. The cast is absolutely terrific. And I don't mean this as a name drop, but I think I've spoken to every one of them over the years. The last one I spoke to was Roisin Gallagher in studio, right where you're sitting now, for How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, the Netflix show. Hope RTE won't mind me mentioning that. I'm sure they won't. But you know, people like me get obsessed with accents, but she's still very northern when you meet her in terms of the accent. And yet, she is no perfect in this. Like, she really sounds like she's a dub, like you or I or whatever.
Yeah, and does it, I mean, I'm sure in the background she does a lot of homework.
Yeah.
but kind of it's fairly effortless. You don't.
Yeah, it looks that way.
In the first series, there was a few times, and you know, I was keeping my ear out for it, but it really didn't. It didn't jar at any stage, and now I just take it for granted. Mm. And it always is a bit of a shock when I see her being interviewed or something, or talking on set, yeah, obviously offside, and you hear her native accent. And it's such a surprise because she's so perfect at it, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure she was relieved as well. You didn't have to give her notes on her accent.
No, but she's great. She's like, I mean, Nancy will say this as well, I'm sure. When we when she auditioned, she hadn't done a huge amount. And so when we got her tape, it was kind of a bit of a conundrum because it was brilliant. Yeah. She was from the beginning. You could see what a great reader of a script she was, her comic ideas. But yet she didn't have much of a track record, which was kind of unusual.
Yeah.
So we were sort of a bit flummoxed saying, okay, are we taking a risk here? Or because she was so good, you know, that we knew that she was in contention earlier on.
She was extraordinary. Yeah. And she was able to bring such depth and emotion. You feel what she's feeling, but also in the same breath, be a comic turn and be a comic foil. A lot of times Shiv is the straight guy in the scene.
Yeah.
And Roisin was just so good at that. And we just had never, she blew us all away.
Yeah. You know, when I was talking to Roisin about the aforementioned How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, I did bring up the dry at the end. I'm not sure if Netflix were thrilled about that, but these are the waters we swim in. And she was saying that she was kind of surprised by, she's regularly stopped by people interested or maybe the other side of the sober life and haven't gone through addiction. Have you found you've had a lot of people discussing that aspect of it with you, that you've written a, you know, a piece about, and it is messy. Let's use the phrase messy, for staying sober can be very hard. Have you been surprised by the, because Roisin seemed, she was surprised by the amount of people who've talked to her about that in a pleasant way.
Yeah, people wrote, I was very moved and surprised. I didn't expect it because I didn't know what to expect when we put the show out. But people wrote to me on Instagram and things. And the thing that they most said was that they'd gotten sober and it had felt very lonely. And their families had started to understand it through watching the show. And actually, some of them got apologies from their families because some of the things that happen in the show happen to people in real life. The fact of dismissing the fact that they have a problem, because we have such a strange idea of what alcoholism looks like.
Yeah.
We have an extreme idea of what it looks like. And if you've somebody who's been quietly navigating a drink problem and one day you say, I think of a problem, and everyone says, no, you don't, what do you do with that?
Yeah. It's a very funny scene in it where she's talking to some Gen Zers in an art class and they're disappointed she wasn't addicted to heroin. It was just plain old booze. Paddy, not to get boring about locations, because that can be a switch off, you know. We spent hours looking for this place, but the house, particularly in this season, without giving a spoiler, where the Sheridans all flew out of and some people want to get back to again and we're all in search of the home. It is a great house. Does that house exist in the south side of Dublin somewhere, and was it problematic to get it?
It does exist, and I saw it quite early on in the scouting process and just very quickly knew this is brilliant.
Yeah.
It offered so much in so many ways, and it became a bit of a character.
Yeah.
So when this series started, when Nancy, you know, towards the end of the last series, they were going to sell the house. And I got really worried because I said, oh, it's like, in so many ways, it organizes the piece visually, but also it's a meeting point. Mm. It's where the family, you can have scenes where they can all fit into a room and talk to each other and all of those things. So I was kind of worried about that. But in not having the house, it creates another energy, which was great.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where they start, where they're fragmented and lost.
Yeah.
And trying to settle, not all of them, but some of them trying to settle or find themselves in their new place.
Yeah.
And that was a great energy to start with.
Yeah. And without giving a spoiler, the house may have some role to play, but let's leave it at that. Either of you can answer this. I just want to mention Ciarán Hinds, because he does the kind of, like, he's a fish out of water of modern times, and yet he's into Pilates and extracurricular things with people and stuff like that. So he streams in this strange blend of kind of a modern man, yet a fish out of water. What's your take on that, either of you?
In the character of Tom, you mean, Ciarán's character?
Yeah, no, I don't mean him as a man. I'm sure he's very much a Renaissance man. But his character is very interesting.
Yeah, I guess he's somebody who we meet him in the middle of an identity crisis. We meet him in season one in the middle of, he's in an open marriage that's actually not very successfully an open marriage, and having an affair with his acupuncturist. And then through the season, he kind of comes to realize that he's in love with his acupuncturist, that him and his wife need to maybe make some changes. But I think there's always something about Tom that he's trying to find himself. In season three, I think he has kind of found himself. Yeah. He finds himself in season three in a way that I think is lovely. But I think his connection to Bernie, I think what Paddy and I have really enjoyed is the relationship between Bernie and Tom.
Yeah.
As a couple that have been together a long time and through a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that comes in a, you know, later parts of the show. There's a couple of brilliant scenes between them, you know, and where their Palm's acting and Kieran's acting just is really shines through, you know.
Yeah, and Palm is terrific in it as well. Nancy, I did read in the Irish Times the other day your own parents' marriage, in that they divorced early in your life at a time when people stuck it out because divorce wasn't really legal. Well, it wasn't legal and it was taboo. And, you know, I really liked your take on it. It was basic, not to tell you what you said, but just to remind you that, you know, they split up and thank God they did, because lots of people who weren't meant to be married stayed together. Can you just tell me your take on that? I mean, I presume you only told the Irish Times that 2 weeks ago, so you still very much believe that.
My parents split up. There wasn't, divorce wasn't legal until 1995, and they split up in the late 80s when I was seven. And they did it very openly. I mean, they never spoke badly of each other. They did it consciously, I guess. Like, they would hate the term consciously uncoupling, but
I bet they would.
We all know that's what, you know, they did it in a way that meant that it wasn't traumatic. And it was difficult because society there wasn't loads of people with separated parents, but they did it in that way. And what it taught me was that relationships, it doesn't mean, just because a marriage doesn't work, doesn't mean the relationship was unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And they really showed me that, and they lived that. And in the show, I wanted to show the same thing. I wanted to show there's different kinds of love, and love can endure, and we don't always have to follow one path.
Yeah, beautifully said. And the old Tolstoy quote I always think of, particularly when I watch The Dry, that every family is tragic in its own unique way, whether people get separated or not, you know?
Yes.
And Nancy, indulge me for a second. Paddy is the director of one of my favourite movies, I Went Down. I'm just curious to know, a movie in the works? We'd all love to see it. Well, I certainly would.
Myself and Nancy are hopefully... Oh. Have you started writing yet, Nancy?
Yeah, I haven't started writing yet, but we're nearly there, Paddy, with the writing.
Okay, so you're going to do a movie together?
Yeah, Nancy's written a sort of outline of it, and Element are involved.
Oh,
and,
fantastic.
So hopefully that's
Queen Ireland.
Push on ahead, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Are we in developmental hell at the moment?
No, it hasn't. We haven't even, it's sort of, Nancy's been pretty busy, and so I'm now not so busy, so I'm able to nudge Nancy a little bit, you know.
Okay. We've got a good idea, and we've got territory. I think what we have really enjoyed working together so much, and we've found territories and areas that we're both really interested in.
Yeah.
And I think we're kind of excited to kind of tell a different story, but that allows us to kind of explore the things we're both interested in, I guess.
It was a couple of years ago. I think it was around Christmas. We'd had a meeting about The Dry or something. I can't remember. And we were on the train on the way home, and Nancy mentioned a film that she really liked that I really like as well. And so that clicked it.
You have to tell me what the film was.
Paper Moon.
Oh, I thought he was going to say I Went Down. No.
But that is also a terrific movie.
Thank you, but I wouldn't.
Well, we watch this space with interest. In the meantime, if you want to see what they have been working on, it is a great Irish show that has been there for a couple of years. Its final season is now available to stream on the RTE player. The Dry Season 3 was written by Nancy Harris and directed by Paddy Branock. Guys, thanks a million.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a million.
Nancy Harris and Paddy Branock there, talking to me about The Dry, which, as I mentioned, is now available for your streaming pleasure. And it is a pleasure. It is a great show. After the break, a brilliant new book all about how music in the movies changed irrevocably in the 1960s. Now, Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, author Wayne Byrne, I think, has been on this show more than anyone in the last 7 years that I've been doing it. It used to be Niamh Algar, but I think Wayne is now beating her because he seems to write a new film book every year, if not every 6 months. He's previously spoken to us about books on Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Walter Hill, to name but three. His latest collaboration with his friend Amanda Kramer from the Psychedelic Furs follows their book from last year called Hired Guns, which was all about female backing music. Musicians. We didn't do it on this show because, you know, it is a film show. I would like to, but, you know, I answer to higher people than you, my friend. However, their latest work is very much about movies and film music. It's called The Evolution of American Film Music, 1960s to 1990s, The Inside Story of Shifting Soundscapes, which looks at the remarkable challenges that went on in film music during this pretty challenging time and exciting time in Hollywood with the emergence of New Hollywood and indeed its later collapse. And so Hollywood moved from classical music to other types of music. I'm delighted to say for the second time in the last calendar year, Wayne Byrne joins me in studio. Wayne, how are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me back, John.
Another book, another year.
Absolutely.
I feel like singing Johnny Logan, but I won't because that wouldn't do anyone any good. So listen, this period in Hollywood alone is fascinating because we're getting out of, you know, the old Hollywood system into new Hollywood and movies like Easy Rider and then Scorsese comes along and all that kind of stuff. Did a similar revolution happen in film music? Is that why you wanted to write the book?
Yes, well, it started just because it's a period of cinema that both me and Amanda love.
Yeah.
And it was just born out of our late night conversations, you know, kind of enthusing about music and film and art of this period. And I said, you know, why don't we write a book, you know, because we really loved working together on Hired Guns and that was a pleasure. So we said, listen, we talk about it enough, we might as well put it down on the page. And the interesting part of it is, like, it's something I'm, you know, you could say theoretically, academically, whatever, interested in that period because I write about it a lot anyway in my other books. And Amanda, of course, lived through it. She was born in 1961. So she was growing up in New York when all these things were happening, you know, across the 60s and 70s and into the 80s is when she started her musical career. So from the personal point of view and the technical, she was there when synthesizers came in and became part of her musical world and professional life. So, yeah, it started, we said we'll start it in 1960. But really, I guess the intro of the book starts in, like, you know, 1959, because that's when jazz music really started coming into Hollywood, you know.
So this is a very interesting answer so far, but you haven't given me the answer to the question I was asking. But I think you're about to, as in, did film music change around this time?
Yes.
Because of jazz.
Because of jazz, yeah. So that was my roundabout answer. So, yeah, so you had Duke Ellington doing Anatomy of Murder in 1959. You have Louis Armstrong doing Paris Blues. And, of course, the great Miles Davis, Elevator to the Gallows, Louis Miles film was so influential and so explosive.
And was this because Hollywood was starting to use people to compose music specifically for the film and not using just orchestras and stuff?
That's right, yeah. So you have the jazz coming in and that kind of, it represented a shift in pop culture and culture in general as well. And then in the kind of mid-60s, you have the likes of The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde and Easy Rider going into the late 60s. And they were starting to use pop artists and rock artists to compose.
So, not to cut across you, but with The Graduate, I mean, I always say about that movie, the music is kind of a character in it. Like, there's scenes with Dustin Hoffman and the action is being conveyed by what Paul Simon is singing along with Art Garfunkel. So this really is a turning point.
Oh, it was huge, yeah. And not just for cinema as well, but for film music, because, you know, you had the whole cross-promotional end of the thing. So, you know, that worked out commercially for the record labels and for the film studios, that kind of symbiotic thing, which would, of course, would really blossom in the 80s, you know, with all those pop song soundtracks.
Yeah.
So that's where that whole thing led to. But yeah, it was a huge shift in film music and culture.
And film music becomes no longer a thing we'll think about after the fact, nearly almost. It's not front and center, but it's high up the priorities of filmmakers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I say, take Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, where the whole soundtrack is Leonard Cohen. You know, and like with Simon and Garfunkel, with The Graduate, and then you have other single artist soundtracks going on as well. And then, of course, the compilation stuff starts coming in. Easy Rider was the one that really blew the doors off on that one.
Okay, how so?
Well, what happened was, originally, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young were going to do the soundtrack as one of these kind of soul artist collaboration things. But there's a story that goes that they arrived up to a session with Dennis Hopper in their limousines and with their entourage. And Dennis Hopper said, "This is not the kind of people I want working on this movie, man. This is, you know, counterculture."
Yeah, yeah.
And they had been temping the soundtrack with all these various other bands, you know, before they, you know, when they're putting the film together. And Dennis said, "Forget about CSNY. Let's stick with these bands we've been using on the temp track." You know, so that became kind of a compilation thing then.
Right.
You know,
and so one of those bands was Steppenwolf, right?
Steppenwolf, Born to Be Wild, which became iconic, you know, that opening scene. And of course, the band with their song, Wait, for that great montage in the middle of the film.
God, I feel like watching it.
Yeah, and you have Roger McGuinn and the Byrds and everybody in there. You know, it's really, really great soundtrack. And that showed, like, the film was, you know, so influential and so important in the trajectory of the new Hollywood era and the soundtrack, of course, with it. So that really showed what could be done with these kind of compilation soundtracks.
Now, you do some interesting research and look at kind of relationships between filmmakers and kind of their go-to composers. Yeah. And I'm thinking of, you spend a lot of time on David Lynch and someone whose name I'd seen, Angelo Ballamenti. They had a, like, I know we're jumping ahead into the 80s here, but that relationship is kind of fascinating because I love David Lynch, but he almost felt like he owned Angelo.
Well, the thing was, part of that relationship was Julie Cruise, and she was the voice of Twin Peaks. Now, they kind of discovered her for Blue Velvet. They wanted this Mortal Coil song for the siren for Blue Velvet, but like with the John Hughes film, She's Having a Baby, they wouldn't give it. So Angelo knew Julie Cruise from the theater scene in New York, and he brought her in, and she had this kind of ethereal voice, much like the singer from This Mortal Coil. Mm. So she did the Mysteries of Love for Blue Velvet, and that was, you know, huge. So when it came to Twin Peaks then, they brought her in because she ended up part of this kind of record deal with David Lynch and Angelo, and the three of them became this kind of partnership.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it became fraught over time. But Lynch had a kind of an element of ownership over Julie because he figured her character, her style, was something he created, you know, which is to a degree true. But she wanted her own career aside from that. So we spoke to her A&R guy, and who was also David and Angelo's man as well. So he gave us a great insight. And of course, Julie Cruise was really good friends with Amanda. So we had a kind of a personal connection there.
Okay. And that relationship, though, by the end of Lynch's life, had kind of fallen apart?
It did, unfortunately, because there was Julie never got to go and have that career that she was primed for, because Lynch kind of had her tied into these contracts.
Now, I'm hopping around a bit, and I'm back in the 80s, but John Hughes's movies, like, we, you know, the music, The Breakfast Club, so many of them. I did actually think for a second he'd done Say Anything, but that was Cameron Crowe, so we don't have to get into that now. But his music guy, Tarkin Quatch, very interesting person.
Oh, he was one of my favourite interviews because he gave us an insight into that whole explosion in the 80s of the John Hughes soundtrack, which was so influential and so commercially important as well.
And just Ask Simple Minds.
Exactly, yeah. And you see, Tarkin was great. So he came from the music industry.
Yeah.
So he was an A&R man, he was a tour manager. But what he brought to it was all these connections. And, you know, back then you couldn't access, like we do nowadays, where there's multiple remixes of various songs just there out in the ether. He knew the bands, he knew the producers. So if Hughes needed a piece of music for a scene, you know, without the vocals, without the drums, Tarquin could get those original tracks. But also, he worked with Hughes in a kind of an artistic way, which is unusual for a music supervisor, because usually those guys are connection men. They have the record label connections. But Hughes and Tarquin worked together with scenes. They would look at scenes and figure out, how can we use a piece of this song or an instrumental and work it in as a score almost. And I think one of the best examples of that is the band Book of Love. They use some of their tracks in Planes, Trains and Automobiles. They strip back the vocals, so it's just like the synthesizer track, maybe some of the percussion. And they also, there's one of my favorite stories in the book. Again, This Mortal Coil turned down John Hughes for She's Having a Baby. So Tarquin went, "I'll ask Kate Bush if she'll write us a song." And it's for the montage at the end of the film where Kevin Bacon's wife is in trouble delivering her child.
Yeah.
And so Kate wrote and recorded This Woman's Work, which is an amazing track.
It really is.
And Hughes didn't want to chop it up just for bits and pieces. So what he did was he reordered the end of the film to use the whole song.
Okay.
Uncut. So the montage and the song go beautifully together. And that's, I love that.
And that was all Tarquin's doing. Well,
that's Tarquin with Hughes, you know, working both his connections and his kind of artistic mind.
Tell me this, blaxploitation movies in the 60s and 70s used music in a new and interesting way as well, right?
Oh, big time. Yeah, and Shaft was really kind of the big one there, you know, with Isaac Hayes, the soundtrack. Yeah. And again, it goes back to the idea of having a single artist create, you know, the score and the songs and kind of cross promotion.
And that was a big thing for you know, for want of a better phrase, black music at the time as
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I have long been, if you know, I have a gun to my head, I'd say my favourite movie of all time is The Royal Tenenbaums. I've sought long and hard to interview Wes Anderson. It hasn't happened yet. However, one of the great modern composers, soundtrackers, is his man, Mark, the unusually named Mark Mothersbaugh.
That's right.
Who did his first four movies. You spoke to him.
We did, yeah. Amanda knows him. Through her band world, you know, because he's in Devo. He's kind of the sonic architect of Devo.
He was in Devo, yeah.
And he's been doing soundtracks since the 80s. Now he started off, you know, kind of more, you know, Pee-wee's Playground, a couple of B-movie, horror movies. Then he kind of started doing some really good stuff in the 90s in the independent scene. And that's, you know, I think he first hooked up with Wes Anderson on Bottle Rocket, which was his debut.
Yeah.
And so he worked with him up through his career. And yeah, they've had a bit of a disconnect along the way, because when Wes wanted him for Fantastic Mr. Fox, he was unavailable.
Wes wasn't impressed.
No.
Wes likes universe building, and he wants people in his universe, which is fair enough.
And it's a very particular universe.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the soundtrack and the scoring of Royal Tenenbaums is incredible. It's a different movie without that music.
Yeah.
And the Muzak versions of like Hey Jude, to me, as well as being my favourite movie, it has the best use of music.
And Mark he has a very particular sound, and I love that about him. That's what I love about some of these guys who came in from the rock world. You know, a lot of the classical composers, there's a certain sound and style they have to adhere to.
Mm.
But when you have these guys who are kind of not theoretically trained, musically trained, they just came up through the rock trenches, they bring a certain sound and a certain style that's so them, and they're irreplaceable in a way.
We were talking about New Hollywood and Scorsese and Coppola, and actually we were talking a book about it a couple of weeks ago about the infant terribles. But, you know, for film historians, and you know more about it than I do, some would say that period not came to a halt, but with Heaven's Gate, you know, the SH-1T hit the fan and directors were given too much air, because that was a flop. And to my mind, it's not a very good movie. There are interesting things in it. But you spoke to the guy behind the music, David Mansfield, who actually plays and acts in the movie as well as looking after the soundtrack. What was he like?
I love David. I knew him from before, from my previous books he helped me out with. So I was able to get him for this one. And it's like, if you're talking about the New Hollywood, and from a musical perspective, you have to talk to David, because he was, as you say, he was there on the front lines of Heaven's Gate, not only scoring it, but in it. So he was able to give a great insight into, you know, working on Michael Cimino, working on that film. And he actually...
And was it chaos?
Oh yeah, absolute chaos. And even how he got the job was kind of chaotic. He wasn't hired as the composer. He was hired to be in the film and to provide some music for that scene, the roller skating scene. And he was just in his off time, just playing along to some of the scenes that he was seeing. And he was recording these little kind of demos. And Cimino used them for temping.
Yeah.
And he goes, this is really good. It suits the film because it's quite intimate, you know, the music David was coming up with. And he hired him to do the whole score. You know, and see, David came from a band background, again, one of these guys, because he was Bob Dylan's guitar player. And he ended up being Bruce Hornsby in The Range and various other...
Yeah. Thanks. Now, I should mention your co-writer, you know, she's not in the room, Amanda Kramer, from the Psychedelic Furs, a terrific band. I presume she's still touring and all.
She's leaving next week to go on tour.
Yeah. So you know, it must be hard to write a book with her.
We do have a limited space of time, and we're just literally finishing up our next book as well.
Which is
it's a follow-up to Hired Guns called Instrumental Voices, The Boys in the Band.
And so for people who don't know, Hired Guns was about female backing musicians, in essence, who we felt didn't get the credit they deserved. You brought them back into light, and you're now doing it with men.
That's right, yeah. So we're kind of, and of course, there's more of them in that field. So it's a bigger book. There's 20 of them this time rather than the 10 ladies.
Okay.
So, but again, it's the same idea. It's kind of shining a light on these guys who play with massive bands. So like Guns N' Roses, David Bowie, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel. The list is endless. Yeah. You know, these are the guys on stage who aren't necessarily in the spotlight.
Is Tommy Burns in it, Billy Joel's guitar player?
No, Tommy's not in it.
Okay.
No. But we have Zach Alford, his
drummer. Oh, yes. Okay, wonderful. Well, I look forward to that. Is Roy Binton in it?
We don't have Roy, no.
Okay, who do you have from Springsteen's band?
Zach was in Springsteen as well.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So he covers that.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to read that. Back to the current book, just for a second. You alluded to it earlier, but in terms of the changing nature of film music in this period, the 60s to the 90s, do synthesizers, it kind of changes the game, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Because with synthesizers, you could be a one-man band, a one-man orchestra. You know, so it kind of leveled the playing field in the 80s. And like I say, that allowed a lot of these new wave guys, these rock guys, to come in and do the scores. So the likes of David Manfield, who we just mentioned. So he kind of straddled both the kind of orchestral and synthesizer stuff. Mm. But then you had guys who are specifically synthesizer oriented,
yeah.
Such as Mark Muttersbaugh. And, you know, when you look at the likes of, say, Danny Elfman, for example, who kind of, again, untrained, you know, not a theoretical guy, but he was coming in with this very strange, because he was in Oingo Boingo, which was a kind of a strange new wave band.
And Danny Elfman gave us the Simpsons theme and Batman.
All those Tim Burton movies. Yeah. And, you know, there was a bit of a rub between the old guard and these new guys coming in because they were, again, bringing their own aesthetic, their own style, which wasn't necessarily tutored or theoretically put into them. So, like, you'd have, there's stories of Danny Elfman annoying some orchestrators and musicians because his rhythms were just very odd, as you know from The Simpsons, you know, something like that. It's just completely him. It doesn't sound like anybody else. And these guys were changing the sound of cinema.
Yeah, two worlds colliding. Yeah. And listen, the book goes from the 60s to the 90s. I mean, did you stop there because, you know, you can't write about everything? Or is it, am I reading through the lines? Do you think film music has gone downhill? Or?
Well, I think the classical orchestration style kind of came back in the 90s. When synthesizers started...
To diminishing effects, do you think? Or?
For me, anyway. Yeah. Because it's less identifiable. It becomes a kind of a oral wallpaper. And I think what happened was when synthesizers...
Now, fans of Hans Zimmer and the great John Williams would disagree, of course.
Well, you see, Hans, I do enjoy his 80s stuff because he had a very particular style on the synth in the 80s. I love Black Rain is one of my favourite soundtracks.
The Michael Douglas movie. Yeah,
brilliant. And you see, what happened is... When the 90s came around and music started changing, culture started changing, all of a sudden the synthesizer stuff started sounding very 80s.
Yeah.
You know, it was dated. You know, so of course then classical never dates. It's always, you know, in vogue. It just depends on what it's competing against. And in the 80s, it was the synthesizer.
Yeah.
And for us, we just felt, well, we documented these massive changes across 30 years, finishing up with David Lynch and Angelo, you know, with the whole Twin Peaks phenomenon and, you know, their work with Julie, we felt that's a nice wraparound because after that, things started to kind of get back to normal a bit, sonically.
Yeah.
You know, and even artistically, films started coming, you know, getting a bit more, I'd say, blander to a degree. I mean, you had the great work in the independent scene that really changed everything in the 90s, but like commercial cinema started becoming just a little bit blander for me.
I take your point. The book is a fascinating one and there is loads in it and we've only scratched the surface. It's called The Evolution of American Film Music 1960s to 1990s. It was co-written by Wayne Byrne and Amanda Kramer of the Psychedelic Furs. It's in bookshops. It's published by MacFarlane. People can buy it online, Wayne, I'm assuming as well.
Yeah, you can get it anywhere you can buy books.
Okay, wonderful. I wish people could be that simple. Wayne, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me again, John.
Wayne Byrne there, talking to me about his new book, The Evolution of American Film Music, 1960s to 1990s, which he co-wrote with Amanda Kramer from the Psychedelic Furs. And my thanks to Wayne. And as he says, it's available wherever you get your books. That is it for this week. If you want to get in touch with me about anything you've been watching, you can email the show, screentime@newstalk.com. Busy month of May ahead. I'll be talking to everyone from the likes of Sally Field to the equally great Bill Nighy. So that's all to come in the month ahead. In the meantime, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of this hopefully sunny weekend. And I will talk to you all next week.